I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond.
And I'm Claudia Wu.
And we're the founders of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine that celebrates women and food. Today is Thanksgiving. We pre-recorded today's show because we're celebrating with our loved ones, as we hope you are.
We talked to the one and only Nigella Lawson last week about her life, her new book, Simply Nigella, and, of course, Thanksgiving. Nigella is British, as you might know, but she's also celebrated many a Thanksgiving and cooked her very first one last year. Here's our interview with Nigella. Enjoy.
Hi, everybody. So we are about to talk to Nigella Lawson. Nigella, are you on the line?
I am. I'm here, ready, willing, and able.
Oh, great. Hi, Nigella.
Hello.
So this is our Thanksgiving show, actually. And from reading your book, I understand that you had your first Thanksgiving last year, Thanksgiving is not a big holiday, besides in America, for some reason.
No, but the reason that it's really about, you know, being enormously grateful to have got rid of us.
Yes.
Did you celebrate in America, or were you in the UK?
No, I've often celebrated Thanksgiving, but it's the first time I've cooked it entirely. You know, I've sometimes brought a dish, or I've helped out, but actually I had American friends visiting, and I did it in London, and it was great. I'd just moved into a new house, and I had packing boxes everywhere, and somehow it felt absolutely right to be making a feast of Thanksgiving.
Do you remember what the menu was?
I remember exactly what the memory was. I remember, can't talk though. I remember exactly what the menu was. The menu was a mixture of really, I suppose, it was a lot of what we do for our Christmas dinner. So I did my brined turkey, and I did cranberry sauce. And I made the make-ahead mash that's in my new book. In fact, two recipes I did really were made for the first time for my Thanksgiving and then made it into the pages of the book because they really worked for me. So I did a make-ahead mash, which was rather, you know, makes life much easier on the night itself, on the day itself. And I also did some green bean casserole, but I thought I'd introduce an English note because we always have Brussels sprouts with our turkey, so I did some Brussels sprouts as well. And to start with, I was rootling about my kitchen for something to do because I didn't want to make a big starter because it is an enormous feast, but I wanted something, and I just went with what I had, and it really worked for me, and I've carried on making it. And I roasted some sweet potatoes in their skin for about an hour in a moderately hot oven, and I got some garlic, and I cut the tops off a whole head, and then wrapped them up in tin foil and put them in the oven for about 45 minutes. And then when they were sort of cooler, I took the skin off the sweet potato and I squeezed out the now caramelized garlic puree and added some chickpeas and a bit of ginger and lime. And I got a stick blender and I made them into a dip.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And I added some pomegranate seeds on top for, you know, for a bit of contrast and texture. And for me, that always looks like a celebratory meal if you scatter some pomegranates on something. And then for dessert, I did quite a bit because I couldn't decide what to do. And I went back to my old pecan plus pie because I feel that for the Brits, mixed nuts are our festive nut assembly of choice. And so I do a pecan pie, but I add other nuts as well. And I made a couple of the bundt cakes that are in this book, which is a cider and five-spice bundt cake, which is like gingerbread, any lighter, and a pumpkin bundt cake. And then I had a bit of canned pumpkin left over from making the pumpkin bundt cake, so I turned it into a no-churn ice cream because I don't like waste. And I made a salted caramel sauce for the five-spice and cider bundt.
Bundt is so much nicer when you pronounce it.
Bundt.
I think we just say bunt.
Because I learned German, I can't help pronouncing it like that, and I can't reprogram myself to say bunt.
Can we go back to the turkey for a second? Is turkey a thing in the UK?
turkey is a thing. Turkey is what we have for Christmas. And every now and then people try and make a change and they say, let's have goose or something. But really, turkey is absolutely what we have on the 25th of December. And although brining is really totally an American approach, I adopted it some years back because I've been so impressed when I've been stateside. And I'm happy to say I managed to convert a load of Brits and others besides to the beauty of the brine.
Yeah, brining is just taking off here. I mean, it was always big with
brining
chefs.
Brining is wonderful. It's such an ugly word. When you say brine to someone, it doesn't sound like it's going to taste great, does it?
Sounds like the ocean.
What's in your brine?
You think it sounds like the ocean. Somehow it just it sounds, maybe because it rhymes with wine, it sounds wine with an H rather than without the H. It sounds a bit sad to me, but it's such a wonderful way, I think, of getting some flavor, but more of getting a turkey to be succulent. But, you know, there are huge national differences in the way the Americans regard the cooking of the turkey and the Brits, because as far as I can see, if I could call it this, the sort of national neurosis stateside about the turkey is that it's going to be undercooked. And the all Brits have a big thing about the fact that the turkey is always overcooked and stringy. So, and I feel, well, the thing about the brine is that it not only makes it succulent, and it means that for those who are afraid of overcooking it for one reason or another, that it's, I don't think it's possible to make a stringy dry turkey if you brine it. But I'm a very bad carver, and I find it makes it so much easier to carve.
What's the secret to your brine? What do you put in there?
My secret is to my brine, I think, is the same secret that is the essence of all brines, which is, you know, quite a bit of salt, like indeed like the ocean, and some sugar, and then the spices. I'm a lazy briner, by which I mean to say that most brines instruct you to boil everything together and let it get cold, and I don't. I just mix everything together with cold water, and I go fully festive, you know. I add cloves. I have all sorts of wonderfully seasonal festive spices, and I also, you know, do oranges or satsumas in it as well. One, because I think that teeny bit of citrus is just right. Added sharpness is necessary, but also because it looks so beautiful as they bob about at the top of the brining pot.
I celebrate Thanksgiving down in the South every year and have a deep-fried turkey. Have you ever had that?
I have, and you know, one year I found myself ordering online a deep fryer for turkeys, which I haven't used because actually it's not big enough, and also, you know, that way madness lies. I think you need to have a big bit of outdoors to be deep frying a turkey. You don't want to be doing it inside a house.
No, as many an emergency room technician can attest to.
Sure. I mean, and also for us, the stuffing is a big part of the turkey. So we always, you know, I always make at least one stuffing.
I read your book last night, and you mentioned your no-churn ice cream. And I wanted to ask you a question about that, because I do make ice cream at home. Can you actually churn the recipe, or just don't
I've
bother?
I've never tried churning it.
Oh.
I mean, the point is, you just don't need to. There's something about, I mean, I hate to think about it, it's probably just there's so much fat and so much sugar in condensed milk that it stops the ice cream from crystallizing. But, you know, and in a way, I do it because it's easy, because you know, you just have whipped cream, condensed milk, and then the flavoring of your choice. So, you know, for the pumpkin ice cream, I add a small bit of, you know, pumpkin puree, and then I add a bit of brandy, and that's it. And I suppose I don't understand why you would then churn it.
just to be fancy. Why would you then churn it, Claudia?
Just to be fancy.
I'm confused, too.
But, I mean, you know, there are many ice creams, and now you can, you know, now that there are really those great and not so expensive attachments you can get to the KitchenAid or whatever mixer. You know, the KitchenAid mixer comes with a bowl that you can keep in the freezer, and then you can make it. You can churn an ice cream in that, and that makes it simpler. But generally speaking, if you're the thing about making an ice cream when you have to churn it, it's not the churning itself that is difficult, but then for a lot of people, making the custard base for the ice cream is daunting. It doesn't have to be, but it's daunting, and it's one more thing to get done. So I suppose if you've just got a bowl and you're stirring everything together, it's just easier.
Since Claudia brought up your book, let's talk about that now. It's called Simply Nigella. It's your 10th book. Congratulations. That's a big landmark.
Thank you. Somewhat odd to find myself having written 10 books, but there it is.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. How does one even do 10 cookbooks?
I don't know, because when I did what, I never intended to be a food writer. My first book was meant to be a one-off, but I enjoyed it and actually immediately gave way to my second because I discovered the joy of baking in my first book, so I wanted to write what then became How to Be a Domestic Goddess, an ironically named book in the title has come back to bite me several times. I can blame only myself. But I suppose that when I wrote my first book, I found my voice. And for any sort of writer, and up to then I'd been a non-food journalist, that's a gift. And I enjoy it, and I feel in writing about food, I write about life. And I suppose selfishly, I just still feel so engaged. And the more I write, the more response I get from readers. And it's become part of a conversation and something that seems a very powerful and important conversation, and I have no desire quite to still my voice yet, but I never know. I mean, I haven't planned a next one. I never do. If something comes to me, I'll do it. But I never want to be a churning out machine. And I have to say, this is over quite a long period. I don't do a book a year or anything. Generally, I leave 2 years between books. This time it was three. Sometimes I do a television series to go with, but sometimes I feel not. So I really, you know, this isn't, there's never a big program ahead of me in that sense. I do what feels right, and I try and respond to that.
So Claudia and I have been fans of yours for a long time, and we know that there's nothing simple about you. So why the title Simply Nigella?
What do you mean there's nothing simple about me? I'm a very straightforward person. Which I am. I mean, in the sense that every human being is complicated, but we are also straightforward. It's just a question of whether we allow ourselves to be.
Straightforward Nigella doesn't have the same ring as Simply Nigella.
What?
Straightforward Nigella doesn't have the same ring.
Well, I think Simply has various connotations, because one level, it's the fact that my recipes are quite simple. They always are. I mean, this book is no simpler than the others, perhaps simpler than my first book. But I'm not a trained chef, not even a trained cook. I don't enjoy complicated food. And I don't believe food needs to be complicated in order to taste good. Flavor can be complex, but the process is always simple for me. And my recipes would not expect any cook at home to be doing anything that was stressful or fussy. Sometimes things take longer, but mostly then the cook doesn't have to do anything to them. And sometimes I will say, look, it's really boring chopping these carrots, but if I can do it, you can. It's not difficult. I'm quite, in that sense, I'm straightforward about what is involved and how I feel about it and how I expect a reader maybe to feel about it, but it's my recipes are really like diary accounts. But also Simply Nigella, I suppose, has also a sense of, look, this is just essence of me, of my approach to food and the kind of flavors I like, how I cook. And here I am. Here's how my life is tasting right now.
Yeah, I like this idea that this cookbook's kind of like cookbook as memoir almost. Mm. And I wanted to ask, from reading the book last night, have you been spending a lot of time in Asia?
Yes, I have. Not a lot of time, but I spent some time there the end of last year, beginning of this year, and I found it inspiring. I mean, I've always liked Asian food, and Asian influences are quite to the fore in London, at least. But it was really extraordinary to be there in this beautiful country as in Thailand and watching how everyone cooked. And I'm afraid I just stare at people cooking all the time, and so every now and then I would take out my phone and video them making a recipe, rather than take notes for when I went back home.
Yeah, I find it shocking how bad Asian food is outside of Asia.
Not everywhere, but
you know, there is always something. I mean, obviously it's so much easier when you can just stroll down and get these raw ingredients that are magnificent, and some I had to tweak the recipes, to suit a kitchen that wasn't in Asia. But nevertheless, I still found it possible to deliver on flavor, and that's what mattered to me. And I think the thing is always to, I need to say what is authentic and what isn't, or how I'm using perhaps inauthentic ingredients to some extent, or certainly not the ingredients I saw being used to create the same flavors or to mimic as closely as possible what I'd eaten.
So, Nigella, you took a little heat for one of the comments in the book about the Clean Eating Brigade. You wrote, "The Clean Eating Brigade seems an embodiment of all my fears. Food is not dirty. The pleasures of the flesh are essential to life. And however we eat, we are not guaranteed immortality or immunity from loss. We cannot control life."
An entirely reasonable approach, I'd have thought. I wouldn't say I took heat. I mean, although when you write about food, it's such an emotive subject that people do react emotionally, and also, you know, newspapers like controversy. I stick to that. I mean, I feel that if clean eating means simply not eating processed food, you know, yay, I'm all for that. I like real food. I don't like junk food, but I don't like smugness. I don't like food shaming. I don't like making people feel bad. And the implication that if you're not eating in a certain way, then it's dirty and shameful. But I think many people struggle with their relationship to food. And in some sense, as I said in an earlier book, that there is really a fear of the flesh, both one's own and the carnal nature of eating. And I think it's quite important not to be cowed by that.
We are at an interesting moment where it seems that everyone has a food thing, whether it's an allergy or they don't eat gluten or they're avoiding this or they're a vegan. And, you know, you throw a party or a dinner party these days and you ask, oh, does anyone have a food thing? And everyone does. And it's almost very hard to plan a dinner party these days.
Well, it is, although as a cook, I find it quite an interesting challenge. And I certainly have many dairy-free and gluten-free desserts in the book. But I like that because I have to think about my recipes in a different way, and I enjoy it. I think you decide whether you're going to take a negative, fearful approach or a joyous one. And I just thought, oh, that's wonderful. I actually have to think about how I'm going to make a gluten-free pie, or how can I make a cake that has no dairy in it and no gluten. And actually, the funny thing is, the biggest challenge to me was doing a vegan chocolate cake, because a very good friend of mine who lives in New York came to London, and I don't like to have, as it were, segregated eating, so I wanted to cook a vegan feast. Didn't know how I was going to do a dessert. I mean, obviously one can provide fruit, and that's wonderful too. And I did a chocolate cake, and I liked it so much that I've been making it for every family birthday or important occasion ever since. My family are not vegan. So I think it's good. I mean, in my first book, I wrote that, you know, cooking is like the sonnet form, that it lies in the constraints. And certainly the constraints of cooking a cake that was vegan proved enormously creative for me.
Why do you think we got to this point, though? I mean, if you had been planning a party 25 years ago, no one probably would have expressed any sort of food they couldn't eat or something they didn't want to eat.
I mean, I think it's partly a lot of people would maybe, apart from not being able to eat food for religious reasons or so forth, that I think people would have thought, well, I'm going to someone else's house, so I'm going to eat what's given to me. So that there was a different attitude.
So we're just less polite these days?
I don't know about that, but I think more things are understood and there are more different sorts of foods available. I think there's a lot of fear around food that, as a generation, everywhere in the Western world, we're at our most detached and distant from the production of food. And I think because of that, we are more easily spooked by it. We don't know what goes in a lot of food. We don't quite understand what's happening. And I think that there's this need as well, and why I said in the book that, you know, what you eat cannot guarantee your immortality or immunity from loss, is because I think some people think that food somehow will make everything okay or not. You know, will, if we eat like this, we won't die. If we eat like this, nothing will go wrong in our lives. When we try and use food in a way as if it could be a magic shield, then of course it can't be. But I do believe that how we cook and how we approach food makes an enormous difference, because in some sense, it's one area in life we can have mastery over ourselves, but we can have mastery of ourselves and how we choose to cook. And the wonderful thing about cooking is that sometimes it chooses how it will turn out. So there is, that perhaps we're a very controlling age, but food you cannot quite control, but you can have a relationship where you try and become in a position of power over yourself. But I say that with some hesitancy, because of course, you know, life has a way of deciding what it'll do, you know, however you cook or eat.
I have to ask, for all the gluten lovers out there, what exactly is in your carb cupboard?
Oh, in my carb cupboard? Well, my carb cupboard really is mostly lots of pasta and noodles, and sometimes it's just that I put everything like that in there. I have a sort of secondary carb cupboard, which is, I would say, pulses and, I think they count as, they have a lot of carbs, the pulses and oats of many different sorts. And then, of course, my baking cupboard, which also counts as a carb cupboard, which is many different forms of sugar and flour. But my carb cupboard number one is, it's really every single sort of pasta and noodle you could really think of.
So you mentioned earlier when we were talking about the Clean Eating Brigade that if it means people aren't eating packaged food and processed food, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the world has really shifted more toward what you've been talking about since you wrote your first cookbook. And it's cooking for yourself, cooking beautiful food, taking pleasure in ingredients and the beautiful foods that are out there. Are you happy to see, well, of course you're happy to see that this is, everyone's thinking is coming around to that, but how do you feel about this sort of food revolution that's taking place?
I don't know that it's a food revolution. I think the difficulty is what happens is it becomes maybe a huge disparity between the way certain people cook, which is, you know, for some people, the buying wonderful fresh ingredients is not possible. And that's why I say, you know, really, I don't like food shaming, because I think that not everyone can cook in that way. And I do remember, I don't remember an awful lot from science lessons at school, but I do remember that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So I think things stay about the same. I think that I'm not an extremist. I don't like it if people get so hung up and fetishize, you know, the wonderful ingredients, so that they feel that they have magic powers. You know, the demonizing of some foodstuffs and the veneration of others leads to no good.
What I meant by food revolution, Nigella, was just there seems to be a real rejection of packaged foods and processed foods by the younger generation. These big companies are responding by taking out, you know, food, artificial coloring and flavors. And
no, I think that is very good. I think that's very good. And I think that anything that encourages people to cook is great. But I think that I still worry that cooking is thought to be something that is done in restaurant kitchens. Therefore, when people say they can't cook, they mean they can't cook like a chef. And I always try and say, well, that's sort of theater. That is cooking, but it's not real cooking. And I think that along with the food revolution will only really be taking place when people are happy to cook simply and cook in an everyday way that isn't about having people over or thinking about how to impress others, but simply, I suppose it's about really finding some meaning, which is where it all resides, in the process itself.
So Nigella, on that note, we're going to take a quick station break, so hang on.
I will.
Everybody, thank you for listening. We'll be right back with Nigella Lawson.
We'll be right back. Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we're the ladies of We Dig Plants. And today we're asking you to dig deep into your pockets and help us grow this radio station and our podcast and everything that you know and love about us.
How do you do it? You go to the heritageradionetwork.org website. You will see a beating heart. It's on every page. And you can give a dollar. You can give $5. You can give whatever.
$500.
$500. $5,000. Just click on the heart, donate, and help support the radio that you love.
All right, everybody. Hi, we're back with Nigella Lawson. Nigella, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
So we were talking about the home cook. Claudia and I saw you speak with Gabrielle Hamilton at the 92nd Street Y, and you did spend a lot of time talking about the home cook and what that means these days to be a home cook. And you're someone who's been celebrated for celebrating the home cook. I feel like you've been a champion for since your first book. The Art of Eating Well, which Claudia was reading your new book, and I was revisiting that book, and I was really struck by a few things. I was struck by there are no pictures in the book, and it's amazing how cookbooks have changed in terms of art direction. And I was wondering
although it was considered a bit odd then, it's just because there was so much writing in the book. It was really a reading book. I think, actually, we've gone through such a period of lavishly illustrated cookbooks. My own feeling is that it's probably now, we're at a time when you could bring out a book without pictures because we've become almost saturated by the image.
Well, it's funny because you have a journalist background, so you did win a British Book Award Author of the Year for How to Be a Domestic Goddess, which I guess can attest to the quality of the writing in all your books. When did you decide to take that leap? I mean, you started going, you made a television show, which is very different from the written word.
A television show is very different from the written word, except that I'm not scripted and I talk, and I try and talk in much the same way as I talk at the beginning of each of my recipes in the books, but of course you can't fit as much in. The language I use on my television shows is important to me. It's important that it isn't just instructional, although that's essential, but I try and evoke tastes, textures, and just... What I feel about a particular recipe or ingredient. So it's my language is perhaps not the language normally associated with food programs either. I never really made a decision. The first, as I said, you know, earlier, the book was meant to be a one-off. I wasn't convinced about why I was writing it, but I did, and then I loved it. I carried on being a journalist, and I was at that stage. I'd stopped being a literary critic, and I had become an op-ed columnist. And I carried on the two careers, you could say, in tandem for quite a while, and then it became hard to. So I stopped my journalism. But I had 10 years of overlap, and I'd had 15 years as a journalist before my first book came out. So I don't know. I feel that I'm sort of outside the food industry, whatever that may be. It's me. I cook still in the same way as my readers cook, and the difference is I write about it or speak about it on television.
I think the things that I love about your books is that they really are wonderful to read. I mean, I really like a cookbook that tells a story and that you can read almost like you would read a novel. And you know, I love what Nigel Slater had to say about you, that there's an intelligence to the way you write and that you expect a certain intelligence of your reader as well. And I think that's missing from a lot of cookbooks today, the ones you can
read. I do think that however wonderful a recipe, if a book is just a formula for how to cook something, it's missing an opportunity. And I like when I read a food book to feel that I'm engaged with the certain intelligence, or that intelligence engages me, and also that I feel that there's a real voice there. I mean, otherwise, there are many recipes on the internet, and that they're great too. But a book is a different contract with a reader, and for me, it's so important that a book can be read as you say, almost like a novel, as well as being an entirely reliable manual. Both conditions have to be met. That to me is so important.
So we were very impressed.
When I first went into it, I think I went into it as a former student of language, and it interested me whether I could use language, which is in itself abstract, to conjure up a world where the language belongs really to the realm of the senses. And it's quite difficult, but that was a challenge, and that's what I like.
Were there people who inspired you in terms of your cookbook writing?
There were people who inspired me, but I'm glad to say a bit rather retroactively, which is that there are a couple of writers who, had I read them while I was actually writing my first book, I think I would have been so daunted I'd have stopped. And one is Laurie Colwin, who was a wonderful writer, a novelist, but predominantly a brilliant short story writer. And then she wrote Home Cooking, which I think the subtitle is A Writer in the Kitchen, and then there was more Home Cooking. And they are the most wonderful books, which are funny, clever, witty, charming, very moving, and they're about how she cooks and her life, but not in a, as I say, not in a confessional way, in the same way as my books are very directly about my life, but not in any confessional way. And the recipes just are within the narrative, as mine were a lot in How to Eat. And I do think if I'd read her, I'd have thought, oh, well, this is so brilliant. What am I doing? But luckily, I came across one I was about two-thirds of the way through. And another book that inspired me is a book that's not enormously known in America and actually not enormously known in the UK, but is huge in Australia, which is a book by the sort of grand dame of Australian food writing and cooking, and she's called Stephanie Alexander, and it's a ginormous book called The Cook's Companion, also not illustrated, and it's a wonderful riff on ingredients and what goes with what. All the recipes, and there are so many of them, are listed, come under, you know, the ingredients there, and then many recipes, and then in the margins, it's what other recipes could be made with them, or what ingredients go with what else. So my first book very much had margin notes like that. And as I say, I was very glad not to have seen that, because I'd have thought, oh dear, this looks a bit like I'm doing the same thing, although it wasn't at all the same thing. But I found both approaches enormously inspiring. I also, in terms of other writers, I don't know that I ever try and have anyone else's voice other than my own, so it's more that they give me pleasure than that I find them inspiring. But Calvin Trilling's writing I like a lot. There's a lot of his food writing gathered together in a book called, rather wonderfully, The Tummy Trilogy, and that's a fantastic read. But Gabrielle Hamilton, you know, who I did speak with at when I was in New York, I mean, her memoir, Blood, Bones and Butter, is an extraordinary piece of writing, and it's not just of interest to those who are cooks. It's not really just a chef's memoir. It's a wonderful exemplar of what a memoir could and should be.
We're huge fans of that book, but I also this summer reread Laurie's two cookbooks, memoir cookbooks.
Wonderful?
They're so great. I mean, and ultimately, it's hard to read them today knowing that Laurie passed away at such a young age.
Oh, I know.
And it's hard to believe that she does have there is her body of fiction, but it's hard to read those two books knowing that's it. That there's, when you get to the last page of the last book, that's it. There's no more.
I know. I find that it's extraordinarily moving and difficult. And for a long time, I became quite obsessed with her daughter, who she writes about so movingly, and how she is, and how she fared in the world, and to be deprived of her mother so young. These books really tear at your heart.
Mm-hmm. Are you moved to write perhaps one day something that's not a cookbook?
No.
Really?
I'm not. Before I thought I was going to write with a capital W, and that, you know, my first book was a bit of a, you know, warm-up exercise. But when I wrote it, I felt I found my voice. I have no desire to cook. I don't know why I said that. I have no desire to write about the world differently. And I don't know whether that's because that I feel that one would be so exposed. There's something about writing about food that one has this structure to cling to, and yet one is very exposed in writing, say, fiction. And I certainly have no desire to write a memoir.
I have to say I'm slightly bummed out because I love your writing, and I was secretly hoping that you would say, yes, you'll write a novel one day. Yes, maybe you'll write a biography of someone.
Well, you know, the thing is, well, maybe a biography of someone would be interesting. But the thing is, I was literary editor, deputy literary editor of the Sunday Times from a young age. I was 26 when I was appointed to that post. And I was also a Booker judge. You know, the Booker is our great literary prize. And I read so many good contemporary novels, or you know, a lot of fine writing that didn't move me, and I became terrified, and I thought, you know, if I read a novel, it'd probably be the sort of novel I didn't really want to read or didn't really impress me, and that was too frightening a concept.
I think that seizes on why so many people are afraid to cook, because you watch these food shows and you look at these beautifully photographed and laid out cookbooks, and you think to yourself, I could never cook like that. But I think you've done a lot to help people sort of get over that.
Well, I certainly think when people see my shows, they see I can't hold a knife properly. And, you know, it's my director always says, he calls me Nige. We've worked together, you know, since time immemorial. You know, I've worked together the same crew, a small crew. And he always says, Nige, I can't look at the monitor when I see you holding a knife.
Have you had any onset mishaps?
Many. I'm always grating myself or cutting myself and burning myself. But I am quite clumsy. But of course, it also means that I know what to avoid, or I can't attempt things which require expertise and dexterity. And in that sense, I have to become quite creative, as I say, with spicing and flavoring. But people can see that. I mean, I think that my recipes show that. I mean, if I'm talking through a recipe, I might say the sauce will thicken, but there is a stage when it goes very runny, and don't panic. Now, if I knew more, I would never panic when it got runny, because I would absolutely be certain of how it would turn out. But because I share some of the same anxieties as my readers, I do go through that stage of panic, so I'm able to understand it. But certainly, perhaps it's more visible on TV, because you can see that I can't do virtuoso chopping, and when I pour something from one bowl into another, there's sort of really always spillage. Things like that. You know, it's not an affectation, it's just quite real. But I think I believe that when you cook, you're trying to create food that will be great to eat. I'm doing it for applause or to impress. And then I think if that's your aim, it becomes so bound up with how people are judging you, and that is paralyzing.
Are you the kind of home cook that sets out a mise en place and reads the recipe?
No, not at all. When I bake, I do. I do get my ingredients out before I bake, but when I cook normally, sometimes it's touch and go whether the onions will burn before I find my cumin seeds.
I saw a clip of your new show, Simply Nigella,
yes,
where you were making some granola bars, I think.
Or breakfast bars.
The breakfast bars. And you were wearing gloves when you were pushing them into the pan.
I call my CSI gloves.
Yeah, and I was like, I feel like that before, I would always see you on your shows just like using your hands.
I do use my hands a lot. But if I have sticky stuff, I find it's much easier to press down wearing gloves. There's something, I mean, obviously, in fact, what I really would like to be is a doctor, because I glove up at the drop of a hat.
We all need CSI gloves in our pantries now.
You know, but I agree, when I'm cooking normally, I don't. But if it's something that's very sticky and I find that I can't make it go into a tin because every time I put my hands in it, I lift another bit of the ingredient up, then I find gloves the easiest way to do it.
That's a good tip. Okay.
That's all. I do what I do. But I certainly, when I'm mixing ingredients together, I mean, if I'm tossing a salad, I wouldn't use gloves.
So, Nigella, a few more questions before I turn you over to Claudia for the speed round. But since this is Thanksgiving, what are you doing for this Thanksgiving?
What I'm doing in this Thanksgiving is, well, I don't actually know what I'm doing, but I will be in the States. And I suppose I'll have to go and eat in a restaurant, or else find, I might have to find a kitchen I can use. And I'm doing some filming for the BBC, and so I will be with my crew. As I say, it's a small crew. There'll probably just be six of us all told. So I might try and see if I can find a kitchen, and then we could cook together, which would be rather wonderful. But otherwise, I don't know what Thanksgiving is like in restaurants. I suppose it's a bit like Christmas in restaurants in England, which sometimes, you know, I find quite alienating a concept. But we'll be celebrating it stateside, which will be wonderful.
It can be a little glum in restaurants. I've done that before. But if you and the crew want to come to Arkansas and have some deep-fried turkey, you consider it an open invitation.
Or you can come to my
regret that.
You can come to my aunt's house where we have, like, the Asian Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's interesting. So what do you have for an Asian Thanksgiving?
It's just a mix. I mean, we always have a turkey, regardless. But then all the other dishes are kind of like a weird hybrid of some sort.
You see, that is a wonderful, to me, that's so inspiring. And I think that that's why Thanksgiving is such a wonderful feast. It can be adapted universally in the States, and everyone brings their own approach. And yet, of course, it is still the same feast.
It's the same emotion behind it, the same feeling.
Nigella, what are you most thankful for this year?
I'm most thankful to have, well, many things. I'm thankful that I actually got my book out. And I'm thankful to be able to share that with people. And I'm pleased to have done it. There were times when I thought I was never going to deliver it on time. I'm pleased to have a house to live in and that my children are happy and healthy.
All right. Speed round time. Coffee or tea?
Tea.
What's in your refrigerator right now?
Alas, I'm in a hotel. My refrigerator is just too depressing to enumerate.
Slowly rotting. What's your favorite kitchen tool?
My favorite kitchen tool, I would say, is a fine micropane grater.
What's your favorite food? I know that's a tough one.
My favorite food?
Yeah.
That is a tough one. One food. Well, I suppose at the moment I'm deeply embedded in my chickpea era.
I noticed that from your book. Mm. Do you have a favorite cuisine?
Well, it's too hard to say. I know this is meant to be lightning, but my cooking really, being a Londoner, I've always been sort of influenced by so many different cultures, so it's pretty heterogeneous. But I lived in Italy for a long time, and I think my approach is largely Italian. So as you remarked earlier, that I'm, you know, the beautiful flavors of Thailand are omnipresent. But I think Italian food is, for me, where I return to.
Is there anything you absolutely will not eat?
There's nothing I will not eat, but I'd rather not be offered a green bell pepper. You will never find one in my kitchen.
Didn't the guys from Nopi say that too? Yotam Ottolenghi was here with his chef.
Oh, I love him.
Yes.
But he's got a recipe using a green bell pepper.
I think it was red bell peppers that they didn't like because it was so ubiquitous.
Oh, well, that's just ridiculous. I love him dearly, and he's a good friend, but that's just a mad thing to say.
What's your favorite drink?
Alcoholic drink?
Yeah.
I'm not much of a drinker, but I do like a vodka martini straight up with a twist.
Oh, that's pretty heavy for a non-drinker.
Yes, but I will have one of those rather than rather than lots of other things. But I don't drink it very often, and when I do, I feel very American, sophisticated, and glamorous. But I can't. But then I will spill it as I bring it to my lips and ruin that.
Do you have any go-to restaurants where you live, around your home?
There are certain restaurants that I do really like going to. they're quite informal and small and noisy. You know, I love Marito. I don't know if you've ever done anything with Sam and Sam Clark, but that's a fantastic tapas joint, which is really, I suppose, it's sort of where Spanish meets North African as well. It's incredibly good. And there's also a restaurant I love called Honey & Co., and the chef owners used to work for Yota Matulungi, and it's there is an Israeli couple who do the most extraordinary food, which is quite like Otolenga's food, only in slightly, I wouldn't say rougher, but more rambunctious. But and I love that place too. It's wonderful. So Honey & Co. and Marito are the two places I really love going to. I don't go to restaurants a great deal, I suppose, because I have my new kitchen, and I'd rather be hanging out there.
I know you're already traveling, but if you had your choice of where to go next, where would you go?
Well, I'm very happy. You know, I'm about to go to LA, and that's a nice place to be, so I'm very happy with that. I quite feel like I could do with a stint in Australia. I always find that very inspiring. I think the food is great there.
Me too. I need to go there. Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for being on the show. We really appreciate you being here with us.
I enjoyed it. I'm sorry I was so slow with my lightning responses.
Nigella, we're big fans, as are our readers and our listeners. And I know Claudia and I are definitely, since it's Thanksgiving, we want to just say how thankful we are that you exist in the food world. And you've been a really big inspiration to us. So
thank you
for that.
Sarah. I'm very touched. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your tour, Nigella. Take care.
I will.
So thank you, everyone, for listening. Since today is a day for giving thanks, we just want to let you know we're grateful to have wonderful listeners like you.
Thank you to American Express Open for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb and for supporting small businesses across the country. Don't forget to dine small and shop small and start making your plans for Small Business Saturday on November 28th.
I'm Carrie Diamond.
And I'm Claudia Wu.
Bye, everybody.
Hi, this is Katie Mosman Wadler. I'm the Fall 2015 Julia Child Fellow at Heritage. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Dr. Carolyn Dimitri at the NYU Food Studies Department. Carolyn's the bomb because she uses economics to improve food access for people all across the country.